And welcome from deep inside the Death Star. I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
And this is Defrag, where we answer all of your questions. And you're back from vacation. They let you actually leave for a little short vacation.
It was a very, very useful vacation.
You were actually unplugged.
I was truly unplugged. 6 entire days where I did not touch a computer.
And how's the withdrawal? So I got the shakes
the first 3 days, and then I was able to accommodate. And then when I finally came back and turned on the computer, it was like, ugh, can I just still be on vacation?
Yeah. And where'd you go?
Went to San Francisco.
And that's all we're going to say about that. All right. Nice jewelry, by the way, you picked up on vacation.
Yeah, it's growing on me.
Yeah. All right, first question from Alan Cameron. Thanks for the shows. Great for us sysadmins who get in trouble. That's the best way to get your email noticed by us, by the way, is to say, awesome show. Following your piece about 3-terabyte drives, I have a question. Using 3-terabyte drives as a destination for Windows backup, it doesn't work if the drive is one where the physical and logical sector sizes are 4K. When is Microsoft going to update Windows 7 Ultimate to support the 4K format, or provide a way to format them 4K so Windows backup can work?
So this is a very complicated problem, actually, for those of you that don't know. Drives are getting larger, and in order to accommodate that that size efficiently, they're having to go from 512K sectors to 4K sectors.
Pretty big jump.
And not 512K, it's 512 byte sectors to 4K sectors. The problem there is that the OSs that have existed were never designed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've known about it for a while, but there's a lot of moving pieces in trying to figure out, well, what's the most efficient method of making changes without breaking backwards compatibility, because that's a really big problem. We can't just make a shift and then take out our existing drives.
You know, sure.
We can't make that incompatible, and there's a lot of moving parts like performance, reliability. And the simple fact is that when we had heard about it, the drives themselves still weren't created. So,
yeah.
You know, you're trying to design something for something that you can't even test on yet. It's pretty difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's not to make excuses or anything, but, you know, when you throw out numbers like, you know, Microsoft has known about this for years, it's like, well, pieces of Microsoft might have known about some things for years, but it's not like we're hoarding this information and saying, you know,
sitting on our 4K drives,
exactly
camping.
So, you know, we have support articles about 4K drives. You know, this particular KB article, 251-0009, is our main policy statement for 512 and 4K drives. We did roll out with Windows 7 SP1 and Server 2008 R2 SP1 support for 4K drives in general. But really the things that we support are the 512E. It's an emulation mode that 4K drives can handle.
Yeah.
Now in this particular question, they're talking about Windows backup that's having a problem. Well, it's not actually Windows backup that's having a problem with it. It's another underlying technology that's used by Windows backup, which is the VHD file format.
Mm-hmm.
That is actually the problem. It doesn't support 4K physical sectors on the drive.
Yeah.
And trying to get that updated is, to put it mildly, very, very difficult.
A little bit of a bear.
There's a significant amount of testing costs, development costs, and again, not trying to break backwards compatibility with it. Right now, the only real solution is to not get 4K native drives, is to get 4K drives with 512E emulation.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that you can do is that if you can only get the 4K native drives, is if you put it behind a RAID controller or another disk controller that will abstract that information away from Windows,
yeah,
then everything would be fine as well. It's just that Windows can't see it as a 4K native. If the controller says, no, this is actually 512, then everything is fine. And that's currently the only and best method to still purchase these new drives and have everything just work. What you know, you as users can do is kind of pressure the hard drive manufacturers to
lobby the hard drive manufacturers.
That's really all that you can do to keep the 512E emulated drives in the market. You know,
yeah.
Especially for consumers. Consumers won't know. You know, they get a nice 3 terabyte or 4 terabyte as they come out. They get a nice new drive. They have no idea about sectors.
Yeah.
Right. So we want to make sure that end users are not affected by this, and yet they can be. So they have to clearly mark their drives and say, you know, this is not compatible with certain operating systems. But unfortunately, that's kind of where we're sitting right now.
So ultimately, you say probably the best thing to do would be lobby the hard drive manufacturers, stick with hybrid drives.
Stick with the hybrid drives for, you know, as long as you can. Make sure that they're still producing them, at least for the consumer space. The enterprise space, they have some options with, you know, getting new RAID controllers and being able to abstract that off. When you have drives that are in SANs, it won't really matter. The controllers are doing all the work for you.
Awesome. Okay. Cool. Next question. When I use IIS with PHP and the PHP system saves the session files, which holds information about users' login sessions, etc., in a Windows temp folder. However, during over time, there will be many logins, and the amount of files in the Windows temp folder increases. When the amount of files reaches a specific point, the performance of IIS has reduced dramatically since the seek speed of the hard drive is really high. To gain normal perf again, I need to delete the files in the folder using cmd command del switch fsq winder temp. This process might take a really long time, in some cases many hours. In most situations, the amount of files might be over 800,000, but the file size is always between 2K and 0K. Is there a faster way to delete those files than reformatting the system or using the command?
So this is a very interesting question. I get asked a lot of questions, you know, through the show, through work, through friends, whatever. The first thing that struck me was how this particular question was asked.
Yeah.
The particular person asking the question kind of skirted around the issue of why are there hundreds of thousands of files being created and not being cleaned up by whatever processes creating these files.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's kind of the first thing that came to my mind is if you're creating temporary files, those files should actually be temporary. You know, they shouldn't be hanging around. So, and there's a couple of reasons why those files could be hanging around. There is an outstanding handle reference to the file, so something doesn't get closed, the file stays open, stays around. They could actually be being created incorrectly. There's a particular flag that you can use on create file, which is file delete on close.
Yeah.
And what that does is when the last reference to the file is removed, the file gets automatically cleaned up by the file system, which is really what you're trying to do in this case. You know, you're not needing to have that file stick around.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever's creating those files should actually clean up after it. Now, sure, there's going to be some cases where, you know, a process dies, you know, crashes or whatever, and it's not able to clean up files. In that case, what you can do is don't let it grow out of hand, and you could have a scheduled task that runs periodically that will clean out the files.
Delete the oldest ones.
Delete the oldest ones first.
Yeah, don't wait till it gets to a million files before you do that.
Exactly, but I would actually go and, you know, look at the problem from a different angle and, you know, attack the root. Don't let it get that high to begin with, and actually, you know, change the code if you can. You know, it sounds like, you know, this is their website. I'm assuming IIS does not do this on its own.
Yeah.
And, you know, using third-party extensions, it could just be a bug. It is possible that it's by design and there is a configuration issue.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different reasons why this would happen, but it does seem very odd for it to happen that
way. Yeah. So just try to think of the solution from a different perspective. And
right. Like, there's a lot of different ways of solving the problem. That's how I would particularly solve the problem, is don't even have the problem occur.
Yeah, 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 that's good. Awesome. All right, so next one. We used to be able to send messages to coworkers' machines using NetSend. It doesn't seem to be in Windows anymore. Whatever happened to NetSend?
So NetSend...
I remember this from the day. I mean, this was how... This was like back in the ICQ days when you used to
bang off one
message. Let's go to lunch.
The interesting thing with that is it relied on a service to be running and enabled on all machines in order to, you know, get the message and then display a window.
Yeah.
Now, when you tear apart the problem, you have a networked service that's running in the background that has the ability to throw up UI in the user's face.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the big issue here, and this was in XP and previous, is what happened is the messenger service is the one that handled essentially all of this. It ran in session zero. When we made Vista, we changed how sessions worked. Pre-Vista, session zero and session one, the user session were commingled.
Mm-hmm.
So services could throw UI, they could interact with the desktop. And interesting things can occur in that particular space. The reason why the whole NetSend infrastructure was removed was mainly because of security attack surface. It was a very infrequently used feature when you consider everybody using Windows.
Yeah.
You know, like, yes, we know some people used it, but there are definitely better alternatives, such as, you know, that was kind of the time when Windows Messenger was included in the box, you know, so people could just sign into, you know, back in the day, their Hotmail ID. And then, you know, you could do messaging that way, and it was just on a larger scale, you know. NetSend didn't traverse WAN very well.
It was kind of a fun geeky thing.
It was a fun geeky thing, but command line really, you know, you just had text.
Yeah.
We totally get that it was used in some cases, but there were better alternatives, so we didn't feel the need that that it should exist anymore.
And it was great for pulling pranks on people in the
office,
which is probably a good reason to get rid of it. So awesome.
There is a replacement of sorts that exists in Vista and Win 7. It's called msg.exe, and that is really more to talk in a domain environment to terminal server sessions.
Is that set by default? It's not turned on by default.
It's not turned on by default, so you have to make some
registry
tweaks. You can Bing it. There's a TechNet article forum about you know, MSG, and there is a registry hack if you scroll down to turn on allow remote RPC, which, you know, all of these things, when you start changing defaults, you potentially increase the risk of security exploits. So I don't recommend doing it, but if you're really dead set on doing it, there is a method. It is technically supported because, you know, we allow it. We just turn it off by default because people just don't use it.
Yeah. So if you're a sysadmin and you still want to pull pranks on people, you can go around and set up all the machines so you can do that.
Exactly. Awesome. Although we would probably recommend you to use, what is it, Link or Office Communicator or, you know, what is it, MSN Messenger, Windows Messenger, Windows Live Messenger. That's it. There's so many messengers that have been coming out of this company. It's unreal.
We won't go down that rabbit hole. But next question. So since upgrading to IE9 at home, I see this constantly, which you can show what this is. What is it? What is the harm in allowing it? And how can I say never? The only other option is allow or allow all sites.
So
the message is, the web page wants to run the following add-on, 2007 Microsoft Office component from Microsoft Corporation. What's happening to throw this message in IE9?
There is some web page that is trying to instantiate this ActiveX component. I actually couldn't tell you what the 2007 Microsoft Office component is, because it's not an exactly descriptive title. It could be kind of anything. And the reason why we give you, you know, an allow or an allow for all sites is that, generally speaking, we're trying to help the user. We're trying to put the information in the user's face. But usually what happens is they want to run it. You know, there's an actual reason to run the ActiveX control.
Yeah.
We'd throw up a different message if it was unsigned or if it looked harmful.
Yeah.
Now, if you actually decided, no, I never want to use this add-on ever again, and I don't want people to bug me about it, you can actually turn off the add-on completely.
If you want to do it one time, you can click the little X and it's going to go away. And if you want to do it permanently,
you'd go into settings, manage add-ons, find the particular add-on. You could click on it and enable and disable it. You know, I've disabled some things. You know, I've disabled Link, Groove, Office, because I don't really ever use them.
I tried to disable everything that I can.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't get away with disabling everything because, well, much of the web breaks without certain controls running.
Awesome. Okay, cool. All right, next question. A user has a Mac with OS X and Windows 7 on boot camp. Is there a way to access files, MP3, photos, etc., from OS X and vice versa?
There is a method. It kind of depends on, Win 7 is always going to be formatted NTFS.
Yeah.
So you'd have to get a NTFS driver. There's a few third-party ones. I don't believe OS X supports it natively. It may. I haven't used OS X in a very long time, so I cannot say this definitively.
I do not believe it does.
There are definitely, however, third-party solutions, and OS X can load that third-party solution, which will read NTFS. They can mount the disk that or the partition that Win 7 is installed on, and then read the files. I would not tend to recommend turning on the write capability of those filter drivers because they don't tend to do a very good job, and the last thing that you really want to do is corrupt your other partition. Same thing kind of goes for Windows accessing on the Mac. You can load a third-party driver that'll access HFS, I believe is what is OS X is formatted under, and access those files.
Tell us a better way.
Better way, this is what I would do, is don't stick the files on the machine at all. Put it on an external drive or put it on a network share and access it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that I do is I've got in my machine is I keep all my stuff on my little SD card.
Yep.
So it keeps it kind of off the machine, and I can pull it out if I need to, and I can just stick it in my other computers, and I have all my stuff on there.
Absolutely.
And how would you format that disk so that it can be read properly in both systems?
Unfortunately, I believe the only one that'll read on both without any additional third-party stuff is formatting is FAT or FAT32, so you're kind of limited in terms of disk size.
Yeah, so it might be good to have a small disk or something like that.
Sure.
Cool. All right. Awesome. All right. Next question. I need an expansion that gives the current location of public documents. The environment variable public expands to C users public, but I haven't found any equivalent for public documents. The environment variable public documents and common documents and shared documents are not recognized by Windows 7. Is there one that I can use? And is there a complete list somewhere?
So environment variables are a relatively old method, yet fully supported method,
true,
of accessing locations on disk. There is not an environment variable that actually maps to public documents. However, you can use this type of expansion. So you can actually just go public and then add documents folder to that, and that'll properly expand to it. This is if you're trying to navigate in the CMD window, or if you're trying to go to from the shell.
So they were trying to use an environment variable that was just one term and would drop you there, but this is the better way to do it.
If you're trying to navigate from the CMD prompt or through Explorer, this is a better way. If you are trying to do this programmatically, then we have what are known as well-defined names. And previous to Vista, they were known as CSIDLs.
Mm-hmm.
Vista going forward, they were known as known folder IDs. And this particular page, hopefully,
we'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, well, it's pretty easy to find if you go CLSID, known folder ID, MSDN, and if you do a search for that, you'll find it. This gives you a complete mapping of all of the different known folders. And there is actually one in that case for the public documents.
Awesome.
So you can go to it in this manner. This maps to documents settings, all users' documents. And
we'll just sit and kind of study through some of these.
Pretty much everything is in here.
But there is a list.
There is a list.
So they can check out our link and find the whole list there.
Right.
Cool. All right. So, next question. This is a simple but a good question. What does the OS change when it boots into safe mode as compared to normal mode?
So, safe mode, you know, I'm pretty sure everybody's used it at some point.
Yeah.
I know I do. Safe mode is really a fail-safe mode to get you to your desktop to access the drive and to run regedit.
Yeah.
There's essentially no other use for it other than in, I believe, XP, we added the ability, or even in 2000, to access network resources.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could get onto the internet and then download drivers.
Or try to search for your problem if you can't boot your computer.
Right. So there's it's essentially a minimal set in order to get the OS up and running. We reduce the resolution to a known base resolution. We turn off a whole bunch of services. We only load like disk drivers, video drivers, network drivers in order to get the system up and running. We disable everything else. All non-essential services are turned off. So really it's just a dumbed down version of the system, just enough to get you going.
And hopefully if you're really upside down, you can go in there and start copying all your stuff off to an external drive before you end up in big problems.
Right. In a lot of cases, like what things are defined as being enabled in safe mode is defined in the registry. So it's a particular location in the registry. I leave that exercise up to the user if you want to go find it. One of the problems is that there have been known to be applications and drivers that set themselves up to be enabled in safe mode, and some rightly so. For example, disk encryption.
Yeah.
Those kind of things have to run, or else safe mode is completely useless to them.
Yeah.
So not every possible third-party thing gets turned off when run in safe mode, but most everything does, and most everything should abide by that by that rule. Safe mode, you're not completely safe, of course, from viruses or malware, because they can do whatever they like. They don't adhere to any rules.
Yeah.
So you can never be absolutely certain that when you're in safe mode, you're not running malware. So if you're backing up files, you still want to scan those later on to make sure that you're not copying infected files.
Yeah. So one of the things that might get someone having to use safe mode is that you might have installed something.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about install and uninstall when you're in safe mode.
So one of the services that many installers depend on is Windows Installer, and that is actually turned off in safe mode.
Yeah.
So you can't use Windows Installer to uninstall an application. All you can do is disable the offending piece of software. You can, you know, if it's something wrong in the startup or if it's a driver that's causing a bug check or whatever, you can go in safe mode and manually disable it in the registry, reboot into normal mode again, then run the uninstaller for the software that'll take it out. But there are too many other dependencies on MSI, or that MSI depends on, that has to be turned off in safe mode, so it can't reliably run.
Yeah, and if you have if you have a known application that is giving you big problems, what about just deleting that directory?
That may or may not help, because if you just whack the directory, you'll still leave registry remnants behind. You can potentially cause other issues. So you really do want to be a little bit more surgical about it.
Yeah, last option.
It is truly the last option.
Okay, cool. All right, so next question. Is there a way I can apply environment variables without rebooting Windows 7?
Absolutely. There is a command line tool that you can use that is called setx. This, depending on what process needs to acquire that environment variable. So if it's an environment variable that is used by a service, then the service may have to be restarted in order to pick up the environment variable, but what setx will do is set that system-wide variable, and it'll be available to any new processes that start up or any processes that particularly poll for, you know, an environment variable change. When this gets set, there's a broadcast message set to pick up new environment variables.
Nice. All right, there you have it. Okay, next question. I have some strange behavior. I love this question because this is the typical paranoid person. I have some strange behavior in Windows 7 and I can't copy a file. Oh, this is the next question. It's the weird one. So I have some strange behavior in Windows 7. I can't copy my file or folder if they're locked. Some process is using them. How do I disable this feature? Well, it's not really a feature, but it's a locked file.
It's a locked file. It's a feature in the sense that it's not disableable. It is completely by design. It's telling you that you can't do something.
Yeah.
There is no good method of bypassing that. Like, you can use tools like Process Explorer and manually close the handle to the file in order to release it.
Yeah.
But that has unknown consequences to whatever process was running that had a lock on the file.
Yeah.
There could
and
be
there
a
was
very
probably
good
a reason that it had a lock.
Absolutely. What you could just, you know, tend to do is, what software are you running? You know, indexing software could do this. Antivirus software can do this. There's a ton of different reasons why a lock might be held on a file. And if you want to do, you know, if you're going to do a large copy operation where something might be locked, you might want to just reboot the system, clean up all those locks ahead of time, and then do your operation. You know, if you're having a bunch of processes running in the background that might be watching the file system, you might want to disable that so it doesn't get in the way. But it's not something that you can actually disable.
It's
a protection mechanism.
Yeah, and the thing that I normally tell Dad when Dad, you know, calls me with this one is, reboot your computer. You're probably going to be able to delete that file or do whatever you need to do. It's not,
right.
Probably isn't going to be locked again.
Yeah, and I mean, don't delete or don't reboot the machine unnecessarily. If you're in the middle of an install and then the installer is telling you, you know, you can't do this because the file is locked.
Yeah.
Well, gracefully exit the installer, let it roll back, do whatever it needs to do, figure out what file was locked, you know, and you kind of have to do some preventative maintenance in order to not corrupt yourself.
Yeah.
You don't want to just, you know, oh, I'm going to hit the button and reboot the system in order to clean that up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really know what's going to happen in that case.
Yeah. All right, and this is the suspicious one that I was talking about before. I'm getting suspicious that my PC might have been accessed by someone unauthorized. Like I'm seeing bookmarks change and such. What can I do to monitor my PC activity? What's a simple thing I can do, or some tools or a way to monitor the activities of my PC?
One of the best ways of monitoring in general what's
going
on...
You're going to say log files, aren't you?
I'm going to say the event viewer.
That
is really the best method.
Yeah.
I kind of find it a bit suspicious, you know, depending on what actual OS this person is using.
Yeah.
People don't take over machines in that sense. By default, it doesn't happen. So, you know, if you're using a machine, you're on your home network with a wireless router.
Those hackers are in my machine. That's what everyone's...
It's pretty unlikely because, you know, your machine's just not that interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
People don't really want to target them.
Those vacation photos are just really, I could just look on your Facebook, you know.
Right. You know, your ISP does not normally open up ports to be accessible in that manner. You know, if you've done things like installed software, remote access software, you could have installed malware that installed remote access software, kind of all bets are off in that case.
Yeah.
You know, you could have somebody monitoring on your machine. You don't know.
Yeah.
But there are, you know, there's signs that you can do. You can check what active processes are running, you know. You can get software like Hijack This or Rootkit Revealer. You can check your logs on your router to see if there's incoming requests.
So pull your router manual out, use the web interface, get on your router, see if anyone else is connecting, which you should probably do anyway. Make sure your neighbors or something aren't on your router.
There was a tool back in the day, I don't know if they're still running anymore, it's called Shields Up. Do you remember this?
No.
Yeah, it was by the author of Spinrite, yet another...
That's a good one.
Yet another... tool that I used way back when with RLE drives.
Yeah.
You know, this is pre-IDE.
Yeah.
Big old drives. So, you know, Shields Up is a interesting method just to do a probe of your system as it exists on your network to see what can be occurring incoming.
Yeah.
I think they're still, you know, relatively relevant. There are many different sites like this. that you can go to security software that you can purchase that will do a penetration test of your machine and see what is being advertised.
Yeah.
One thing that you can do is take a look at your firewall. So, you can actually take a look at what is enabled as being able to traverse your firewall.
And if you had malware that was causing you problems like this, it would be listed there?
It should be listed there, yeah. Yes. It kind of depends if it's, you know, listening on a particular port. You can just, you know, look through this list, see what looks suspicious.
Yeah.
You can disable stuff.
And malware might be named something that looks like it's fine. So
so you can...
There's
so like,
always a possibility.
You can check out the details of something, right? So this one is an actual pre-registered EXE.
Yeah.
Let's see.
And why do you have two of them listed there? The other one right underneath that's not enabled?
That's a good question.
One's group policy and yes and no?
I honestly don't know why there's multiples.
Oh, I stump go if I can't
don't,
believe
I,
it.
I don't look at this one too often.
Cool. So speaking of SpinRite, though, I still use SpinRite. I mean, if I've got a disk that's going bad, yeah, I like it. It's an awesome program. It's like my last ditch on checking a bad drive. What do you use if you have a drive that just isn't working right?
Oh, I mean, I just use CheckDisk internally, and I just keep many, many backups. If I find out that CheckDisk, you know, is saying that a drive is going to be going, I say, nah, oh, well, too bad.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to get a new one and, you know, restore.
You always keep everything backed up,
though. I keep everything backed up 7 ways from Sunday.
Awesome. Okay. Next question. Windows Search Indexing is a valuable service, but the problem I have is I might temporarily connect my external drive to someone else's computer or their drive to my computer. In both cases, I don't want the drive indexed. I don't want to see search results for data that might be on someone else's personal data, nor do I want their machine indexing my data. Is there a way to make this not happen?
Sure. There's actually a built-in method to not index something, and that's to encrypt the drive. You can use EFS to encrypt it, and that will completely bypass it.
See previous show on how to do that?
Yep. And that'll be the fastest method to say, you know, it's not accessible.
Yeah.
Or, of course, you have to go into the settings of the indexer and turn it off for that drive.
Cool. Okay. All right, next question. Is there a way to format the PC, Windows 7, without losing the data on it? This is an interesting one. I didn't think it was possible because your format, I mean, you said format. So
right.
That means format.
And also there is not a lot of details into what settings and data they wanted to keep.
Yeah.
Right? Because there are certain data and setting that exists in the Windows directory or in program files.
But of course you had a unique way to do this.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I would do this is just use Windows Easy Transfer and back up your user data and then wipe the drive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just restore it again.
And then the other one you had was you can run setup and do
So if you have if you have the setup DVD for Windows, it's actually a Windows pre-install environment. It's like a very miniature, lightweight version of Windows that you can do. You can boot off of it. You get to the main screen. You hit next once. And then you do Shift F10. That will bring up a command window.
Yeah.
So you can then selectively delete stuff off the file system.
And what are the directories you would delete?
Well, I wouldn't delete any.
Yeah, okay.
In theory. Ask that question differently.
Yeah, okay. In theory, what could someone delete
if all
to
I,
kind of format their computer?
If all I literally cared about was pictures or music, just data files, I would delete the Windows directory. I would delete the program files directory. Those are the two that...
And you're going to lose your apps and all your app settings. You're going to have to reinstall those.
You're going to have to reinstall those, and then you can reinstall Windows over top of that.
Yeah.
I don't really recommend it.
Not the best way to go, and I hope you have your stuff backed up before you even attempt anything like that.
Right. So again, that's the kind of question it's like, well, why would you want to format the system while still keeping your data? It's kind of hiding a reason that we don't really know about.
Yeah.
The only thing that I can guess is that their system is acting kind of flaky.
Yeah.
In which case, you can do a reinstall over top.
Sure, yeah.
But you have to be booted into Windows in order to do that. If all you did, for example, was take the DVD and install Windows again over top on the same partition, you are effectively installing a new version of Windows. You'll get the old one being renamed to Windows.old.
Yeah.
Your data will still exist. Your apps will be gone. So it is similar to the format and keep my data stuff, except that you're still leaving around the, N gigabytes of the old Windows install.
Sure. And that Windows.old, is it safe to just shift-delete that?
You actually can't shift-delete that. You have to use something called the Disk Cleanup Wizard. So once your new install of Windows comes up, and if you've done the whole, I'm not nuking anything, but I'm just reinstalling over top from the booted DVD, and you're trying to get rid of Windows.old, you run the Disk Cleanup. It will scan, blah, blah, blah. This could actually take some time. And there's an
option. You don't run this all the time?
No.
Okay.
You have to click on Cleanup System Files in order for this to show up. It will elevate itself and run again. Now, I don't have a Windows.old on this system, so I can't actually show that to you. But in order to clean stuff up, you can, choose dump files, thumbnails, temporary files, log files, yada, yada.
And there'd likely be a Windows old in there?
There'd be a Windows old in there, and then you could delete that. And
okay.
This tool will delete that for you.
Awesome. All right. And there's probably nothing in there that you would have needed, so.
Well, I can't tell you that.
All right. No guarantees.
There's absolutely no guarantees.
All
right. Back up your data.
All right, last question. We got a guy here. It's got a killer machine, 6-core CPU, a lot of RAM, 3 ATI 4670 cards, and everything seems fine. However, some programs, notably GoToMeeting and MaxVista, turn off AeroGlass functionality. It's still enabled, as in the computer knows that it can do it, but it's turned off while these programs are running. How can I force Windows? I want to force Windows to turn it back on and override the settings from these programs. And I'm a programmer, so if it involves poking around the Win32 API, no, it's no problem.
The short answer, you can't. The longer answer is there's a number of different reasons why those applications are turning off. They're not turning off AeroGlass, per se. They're actually turning off the Composition Engine, Desktop Window Composition, DWM.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're actually turning off. They're turning off composition of the desktop, and they're falling back to other methods of drawing to the screen. And there's a number of reasons for this. Back in the Vista time frame, when this was being designed, certain applications couldn't handle. They didn't work well with composition turned on.
Yeah.
So for compatibility reasons, we have a number of methods that applications can either turn off composition themselves, they can call a particular API. We created shims in order to force applications. They're old, they weren't being updated anymore, but users still use them. So we said, well, given the choice between the app not working at all and the app working, but composition turned off for the life of that process, we went, we'll just turn off composition.
Yeah.
It was...
The eye candy can go.
The eye candy can go for the time being, right? So we shimmed applications to turn off composition.
And many of these applications could be patched or, redone by the developers.
They can be redesigned in a lot of cases. Certain things like applications that use mirror drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the apps mentioned was GoToMyPC.
Yeah.
So older versions of GoToMyPC, for example, use mirror drivers. And mirror drivers is one of those things where when installed in it and enabled on a machine, DWM goes, whoa, we can't handle mirror drivers being installed on the system, so we're going to turn off now because they just don't work with composition. It's Windows 2000 technology. It's been around for a very, very long time, but it's a technology that is inherently incompatible with composition.
Yeah. So probably the first place to start would be download the latest version, the latest update, keep your files, your programs updated.
Yes.
Cool, but there's nothing that you can do manually for the most part.
For the most part, no. It kind of depends if it's an application that is calling APIs itself. Like,
yeah.
it has knowledge ahead of time that says, I want to disable composition. No, you're not going to really turn that off. If it was an application that we shimmed, then you can check the event log and see if, in fact, we're shimming it. And you can turn that shim off for the application, but...
It might break something else.
It might break something else in the app. The app may not work at all.
Yeah.
So you're kind of out of luck there.
Okay, awesome. So lobby the company to develop the software. Tell them, get an update out there.
Yep.
Awesome. All right, well, that's the show for this week. If you want to send us a question, you can write defragshow@microsoft.com, and we'll see you next week.